Hello and welcome to the Sunday Showcase podcast. This is episode 23
now.
23 of the Sunday Showcase podcast. Getting old, where are we?
I'm beginning to go a bit grey. Exactly. On the podcast hairs.
My name's Andrew Learmonth. I'm the presenter of the Sunday Showcase.
My name's David Lewis. My official title is producer, but...
Just sort of person really who turns up and sort of chips in down again, really. Yeah,
kind of points out your weaknesses and then you come up with some line to better me.
Absolutely. And on this week's podcast, not that much on this week's podcast, but...
Well, you say that. There is only two things on this week's podcast, but both of them are spectacularly
both
brilliant.
Both of them are brilliant.
We also have a bonus podcast this week.
Of course, it was Movie Club time, so we have the Movie Club podcast, which you can find slightly underneath this one.
If you just scroll down one level...
On this week's Movie Week podcast, we were talking about rock stars who have acted and, came up with some very interesting discussions, I suppose. You can find that on the other podcast. But we'll start off on this week's podcast with some music from Roddy Hart. He was in Aberdeen on Wednesday and he came in and spoke to my colleague Evelyn Brown. Once we've done that, we'll hear the interview with Larry Gott from James.
Up and coming Scottish singer-songwriter from Glasgow, is that right?
That's right, indeed. That's what they say.
And how are you tonight?
I've been up and coming for about 5 years. So.
Oh, you know, it takes time to be up and coming. You look at David Gray, he was up and coming for quite a long time, wasn't
he? That's true.
So, I've been reading a bit about sort of your tracks from and comments from the press. Mm-hmm. Names like Dylan, a young Jackson Browne, mm-hmm. Willie Nelson have all been banded about. What do you think about that? It's quite praise indeed, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously totally flattering, but maybe they're just alluding to the fact that that's whose record collection I've been pilfering from the most for my album. But no, it's great. I mean, these are big heroes of mine. Early Jackson Browne, I'm a big fan of, and Dylan, of course, is the reason that most songwriters do what they do. And it's nice to be compared to some of these people.
Now, as a singer-songwriter, I mean, you're drawing influences and inspiration from these guys, but mm-hmm. where else do you get your inspiration from?
It just really depends. You know, I can write a whole load of songs based on anything ranging from, you know, relationships to things that are going on around you all the time. But my main sort of source of inspiration is being inspired by great music, actually, something that sort of conjures up a bit of a feeling and a mood and a moment, and that's really what drives me to write. And I guess I write with myself in mind. I always write what I want to hear and nothing else, you know. So that's really what kind of drives me, I suppose.
So what would you be your definition of a good song?
I mean, you've got to have the magic three. You've got to have the sort of performance, melody and lyrics, you know. From a young age, I was really kind of interested in lyrics and songs that were properly put together in terms of their sort of content and how they sort of conveyed a feeling. And I think that's why I was kind of interested in Dylan, for example, because he's such an intelligent writer, but you can still completely... He can write such a simple line and you can still know exactly what he's talking about, but it's the way he constructs sentences and puts verses and choruses together that, you know, you're fully aware how intelligent he is as a writer. And he could, you know, he could just write anything and I would be hooked, I think.
And today he's still as popular as he ever was
when
he first started.
Yeah, because he keeps changing and I think that's the key, actually. And I think that's the thing with singer-songwriters, actually, is that you're not... I mean, there is this tag singer-songwriter, but actually you've got a lot more freedom than a lot of bands who kind of... paint themselves into a corner a wee bit sometimes, and they define themselves a certain style. I mean, I think with somebody like Dylan who kept changing, and that is a really important part of being a singer-songwriter, because at the end of the day it's all about the songs. If you look at somebody like David Bowie, I mean, he's a singer-songwriter.
Absolutely.
But completely, you know, chameleon-like, changing all the time.
You're talking about bands. Do you prefer working on your own or actually in a band?
Well, we're playing tonight with a band, but last time I was in Aberdeen was at the Music Hall playing with Chris Christopherson, and that was just me and my guitarist, actually, and that was sort of acoustic. So, to be honest, I like the best of both worlds. You know, I love sort of having that sort of rockier option with the band, but I also love, I mean, the Music Hall is such a gorgeous venue, and I love getting up on a stage like that where people are sitting down and have to listen to your stuff, you know, whether by force or whatever, but they're sitting there and you've got kind of a captive audience. So it's great to be able to play these kind of quieter songs that people wouldn't necessarily listen to if you're just in a pub and it's noisy and things like that.
And tell me, what was it like working with Kris Kristofferson, for example?
I mean, amazing. Everything you would expect it to be, to be honest. I mean, I've done so many gigs over the years and I've supported... I mean, that is really how you, you know, learn your chops, as they say. You know, you have to work with... You know, you have to support a lot of people to try and build an audience. And I've supported so many people and quite rightly they're all interested in their own shows, so you hardly even see them. They, you know, occasionally they'll say hello, that's it. Somebody like Kris Kristofferson, who's an amazing artist, has had such an illustrious career, was at the side of the stage just about every single night of every single show I've done with him, and wants to talk to you about songs that you've written and wants to talk to you about lines and all that kind of stuff. And he's a real example of how it should be, you know. That's... if I make it that far in terms of my music career, then he certainly taught me a lesson, because he just sort of opened his door to me, and that, you know, meant so much.
He seems to be a bit of a purist. Did he give you lots of advice and tips on how to succeed in the business?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's had some life.
Exactly.
So, I mean, yeah, he just basically said, you've got to keep your head down, believe in what you do and keep going, because, you know, don't try and follow any kind of fads or trends. And, you know, if you're interested in writing songs, then just write them, and people will come around eventually. And that's kind of what happened with him. He was, I think, in a, without sounding too sort of egocentric about it, I think he sees a bit of himself in me, because that's what he said to me, at least, that there's these kind of similarities in terms of, you know, he had a sort of career beforehand, or he sort of, you know, he had a degree and all this kind of stuff. And I was the same. I left a kind of law degree to come and do this. And there's sort of other similarities in the way we write and the way we perform. And we both see ourselves as being more interested in songwriting than, you know, the actual performance of it. It's just a vehicle. The fact that we have to sing it ourselves is just a vehicle through which you have to let people hear your songs, because you don't want other people to sing them.
That must have been quite a decision to leave a law degree and take this up just professionally.
Yeah, I mean, I stuck it out and I got the law degree. I just didn't
practice it.
Yeah, I just didn't want to practice it. So when people say, "Oh, you were a lawyer beforehand," then I sort of have to quickly correct them.
Right.
I don't want to be tarred with that brush, but. It was good to have, and it's actually, you know, held me in good stead for what I'm doing. And, you know, I mean, I'm 28 now, and it doesn't bother me. It's great to have that behind me, and it's great to be doing this now as well.
Right, you've kindly brought in your guitar. You're going to play us a couple of songs. What's the first one?
I'm going to try anyway. This is a new one, so I've not really tried this acoustically, so I'm going to try it now. This is called Dead of the Night. You can
yourself you don't feel anymore. Trying in vain to recapture that dream, but the closer you get, the further it seems. These days everything changes so fast. All the moments you reach for seem so hard to grasp. Blood runs deep, but you ain't satisfied. I can tell by the river of tears that you've cried if you swim before you drown.
Rory Hart speaking to my colleague Evan Brown this week. James, the band were in town on Friday, played at the Exhibition Centre, and I went down there to speak to Larry Gott of the band. And, well, a fairly interesting interview. If you listened to the show, you would have heard the 6-7 minute
version. Well, it was about 10 minutes. It was the highlights.
It was the highlights, the edited highlights of the version. This is the full interview with bits we probably couldn't have put on the radio, and very interesting they were too. He talks about the politics of the new album. He also says why he wouldn't be too miffed if you illegally downloaded the new album. So this is me speaking to Larry Gott on Friday. Reformation of James, back on tour, new album. Where have you been, I suppose, is the first question.
Well, just recently, Edinburgh last night, and then where have we been? All over the place. Everybody's been in different places. I mean, it's been a funny journey, really, because Andy, who this tour is the seven that did the album Seven, and this album Amar is the seven that did the album Seven. So Andy left after the album Seven, so he wasn't with us for Laid, and then I left after or during Whiplash. And then the band carried on. Then Tim left in 2001, and then Jimmy asked me if I wanted to play with him. So I started playing with Jimmy in 2001, and then we invited Tim to join us in 2006, and he said yeah. And then we asked the other three, Saul, Mark, and Dave, and they said yes. And then last year we asked Andy if he wanted to join the party, and he said yes. So we just find ourselves in this position. Must it be 16, 17 years later, the seven of us being back together.
So the new album, Hey Ma, came out earlier on this year and stuff. What was it like sort of writing again with the rest of the band?
It was very easy. I mean, that was the reason that we're here, is that we did start writing again. We didn't get together for a Reformation tour or to, you know, put out some old material. When me and Jimmy were jamming, we were working on new material then. And when we invited Tim to join us, it was purely to do new material. And we had an entire weekend of 3 days jamming in a warehouse in Manchester. And we generated, must be about 60 or 70, improvisations, a couple of which have ended up on the album. 72 was in that first weekend, a song called Semaphore, and I think Waterfall might have even been during that first weekend as well, or at least White Boy. So that was our reason really for getting together, was to write new material. So we always had this album in mind. We didn't know what it was going to be like. We didn't know who was going to be involved. We didn't even know whether it was going to be called James at first. And then the business kind of got interested, and our manager found out we were in the same room together for the first time in God knows how many years, and he phoned the record company and the promoter, and they got a kind of greatest hits together and a tour in spring of last year. And we were very reluctant to do it at first, and then the tickets went on sale, and you know, I think 35,000-40,000 tickets sold out in 2 hours, and it was like, ah, okay, yes, well, maybe we've misjudged the situation a little bit. And it seems that James is more popular now than we were when we were actively promoting ourselves way back when. I think the internet and iTunes and iPods and file sharing and downloads and things like that and YouTube have helped us greatly in the meantime.
So how did the fans react to the new stuff? Because I imagine you have a very loyal fan base and stuff. And so they must always be out there just waiting for Sit Down and Laid to come on.
I think you'll find that the loyal fan base are not waiting for Sit Down and Laid. That's the impression that I get from what they tell me and what I've read on forums and things like that.
Well, maybe not the loyal fan base then, but I suppose there's a lot of casual fans, is maybe the best way of putting it, of people who know you for Sit Down and Laid.
I don't know how to judge them. If they come, you know, people may come to a concert just expecting, you know, a band to do the greatest hits, but we did that last year. We played, you know, we were supporting the Fresh as a Daisy album, which was a retrospective of all the singles that we'd released over all the years from 1983 on Factory, you know, right through till two new tracks that we recorded especially for it. And so we did that then. We played all of the hits. And so they should, you know, if that's what they wanted, they should have come to see that. We've talked about it in interviews. We've advertised it that this is the Hey Ma tour. This is where we're promoting the album Hey Ma. We're coming back again to Scotland in December, where we're playing at the SECC, and that's going to be a blend. That's going to be songs from Hey Ma, some of the singles from Hey Ma, and quite possibly Sit Down and possibly Laid and possibly some of the others. I don't know yet. We don't know what's going to be on the set from one night to the next.
So going back to loyal fans, how have they reacted to the new album? Because I, for my own listening, I mean, it has that sort of quintessential James sound, but it's quite an angry album, and it's quite a political album in a way.
Last night in Edinburgh, we were quite shocked that a song called Upside on the album. When we started that, there's a point in the song where live we've put in a stop, or we've put in a pause, where on the album the song comes straight back in, and we've been playing with the pause, see, you know, how long it can, you know, we hold it. Some nights Tim has held it for quite a long time until the audience have been absolutely silent and then brought it back in. Other nights we brought it back in fairly quickly, but last night in Edinburgh, when we stopped, the crowd came in and just started singing it en masse. There must have been about 1,000 people singing the words of this song that's only been out like 2 weeks. And that was quite surprising. So the reaction to the new songs has been to welcome them like the old songs, their old favourites. I think this album's going down really well amongst the James fans and further afield as well.
I suppose talking about political stuff, Hey Ma, probably the most... I would say it's probably your most political song, probably one of your angriest songs. I thought I understood Hey Ma, and then I read a review of one of your concerts in The Guardian the other day, and I thought, oh, no, I've got it completely wrong. So, I mean, it's obviously about the war on terror. It's obviously about September 11th.
Yeah.
And the sort of the refrain, sort of, Hey Ma, the boys in body bags are coming home in pieces.
Yeah.
So I thought it was sung angrily, but then The Guardian seems to suggest that it was sort of sung almost sort of chilling, but mocking.
It is a slightly difficult one live because James have always been about undermining things. You take a sad lyric and we would play happy music, or you take a happy lyric and we play sad music underneath it. We always kind of like the contrasts. And yes, Hey Ma is a protest song. It's almost angry. And the image of Hey Ma, your son's coming over in a body bag, is quite dark. And yet it is sung in a very kind of jaunty fashion. The only protest song that I can think of that has been in that area before was by Country Joe and the Fish way back in the late 60s. It was sung at Woodstock, and that was called The Fixing to Die Rag, and it was a very happy, you know, and it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? I think a lot of people know that. And in there was a line, I think, that was aimed at parents, said, be the first one on your block to see your boy come home in a box, and it's 1, 2, 3. So if there's a touchstone for Hey Ma, it would be that song. And I think that's a very successful way of dealing with what is in effect a very heavy subject matter. And I don't think people want it sort of like rammed down their throat in a somber, earnest way. And it's just a statement, really. It's a reaction to the news that in America, the images of the boys coming home in body bags was wiped from television. It was banned. You know, it was censored in a way, that the people of America shouldn't see their dead returning home. That censorship, and it creates a distortion of the truth, and it kind of stops the American people from facing the reality of their actions, or at least their government's actions, you know, which I think was a very naive, knee-jerk reaction to September the 11th. You know, when you hear stories that there was about, I think there was 2,800 people died in September the 11th. There's 3,000 people a month dying in the conflict that's been going on for 5 years now. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It you know, if you were an accountant and you were to balance the books at the end of the year, you'd look at that and go, hang on a minute, this isn't stacking up. For an investment of 2,800, you know, we're losing 3,000 every month. It the figures don't add up. The excuses, the reasons don't add up.
Which is all fine to be angry about, but I suppose the lyric itself, Hey Ma, the boys' body bags are coming home in pieces, and it's a sort of a catchy refrain. Do the audience sing it back to you? Do you... Because it has that sort of sit down next to me quality about
yes,
it.
It does. I've read and a few people have spoke to me and said that they have sung it back, but halfway through they've felt, should I really be as jubilant, punching the air, or as happy? You know, the music is making me happy, and the fact that James are on stage is, you know, and I'm singing along is making me happy. But then it helps them to focus on the words. Helps, they have a reaction to it. It's not mindless. It's having an effect. And as an artist, if all you can do is make people stop and think and maybe have a very small effect, we're not going to change the world. Nobody's going to change the world or human nature. But if you can just make somebody have a moment of realisation, even in the middle of a concert, then they may view things differently in future. They might vote differently. They might take part in a discussion in a different way. And that's something to be hopeful for, I think.
Now, I read this in Wikipedia, which means it might not be true. But you guys took part in medical tests to fund the band.
God, is that on Wikipedia?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it is true. It sounds really dramatic. It does sound really dramatic, but there was a point in the 1980s where we'd been screwed over by a record company, and our management at the time, they said the best thing that you can do is split up and reform under another name to get out of a contract, and we refused to do that. But we had no money coming in, and we needed to keep the band going. And a friend of ours was a doctor, and he knew of this incredibly safe drug that he was put in charge of testing. And he knew that we were hard up for money, so he said, come along, I'll take good care of you, and you know, you do get very well paid for it. We wouldn't have done it, I think, you know, out of choice, but it was our friend who, he allayed any fears that we may have had.
And there's been no side effects since?
There was no side... Well, we didn't know whether we were fed the placebo or not, so it was, yeah.
The band, towards the end of the original lifespan, it was sort of quite famously sort of quite a stressful time, and there were sort of discussions between Tim Booth and John Glennie about they had to sit down and have a meeting and stuff. I know, I suppose getting back again and being on tour again, is there a fear that those tensions are going to come back, or those tensions are going to sort of reappear?
It's gone incredibly well. Tim and Jim's...
Jim, not John.
Tim and Jim's relationship did get very strained at some points. Mine and Tim's relationship has been strained at other points. Mine and Jim's, you know, it's like having a seven-way marriage quite often, or whoever's involved at the time. But so you go through different phases, and you can reach certain crunch moments, you know, where things that maybe have been building up for years, quite possibly, come to a head in one moment. And sometimes that can cause quite a big rift, and it takes a while to get over that rift. Maybe the split from 2001 till the other year was needed. Maybe people needed to go away and come back with a different attitude, a different head on the shoulders. And that seems to have happened really successfully. I don't think we've ever been this unified and this productive. And this calm and clear as well. So it's working extremely well at the minute.
Well, I suppose I have to ask you this one about... there's another sort of James legend or James myth about your support acts, sort of what was going on and sort of becoming absolutely humongous. Because you had Nirvana supporting you, you had the Stone Roses supporting you. Mm-hmm. Who else?
Happy Mondays, Radiohead, Texas... Coldplay, the Inspiral Carpets.
Who's in supporting you this tour?
A band called My Federation.
They must have been chuffed to bits when you picked them.
Well, they're hoping that they've been blessed with the same kind of mojo that seems to have blessed our previous.
So who picks the supports? Because you've obviously got quite an ear. And do you sort of keep up to date with current music scenes and the current sort of indie scene, the current rock scene?
Well, yeah. The Twang supported us on the last tour. And they seem to be doing, you know, they seem to be doing quite well. We've always support bands are they're a funny thing. I don't quite know how other bands work on their tours. I know there's various ways. Some people just go for the band that offers the most money to go on their tour, and they'll just say yes.
So the band pays the main act.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
You know, because it's or the record company of the support act do if it's a big enough tour, so it could be purely financial, or they just let the promoter choose who they think, you know, should be on the tour, and they don't really care because they're just there to, you know, play their concert. But we've ever since day one, we were always interested in our support acts. It was always about putting on a whole night. We used to have magicians and dancers and jugglers and comedians and weird dance troupes. And you know what I mean? We tried to break the idea of what a support band was or what a support act should be. And you get loads of music from James, which is the headline band anyway, so why not, you know, entertain the audience with something else? But the support bands work really, really well, and we applied the same method when it came to choosing support bands. We wanted things that we thought were interesting, possibly unusual, and that would appeal to our fans. So we would always listen to the tapes, you know, we'd always listen to them, and if we didn't like them, then we wouldn't take them on tour. So
can I ask who you turned down? Is that...
I don't think we've ever had a... was it Decca who turned down the Beatles?
Yeah,
I don't think we've ever had a Decca moment.
Right.
I don't think we've turned anybody down who then went on to become, you know, interstellar stars or something.
Yeah. So it cured quite a torturous experience of it in the 80s with sort of Factory Records and sort of Spire Records as well, wasn't it? You had real trouble with... Sire. I mean, the music industry has changed massively in the last sort of 25 years, as you mentioned earlier on, with sort of downloading and file sharing, mm-hmm. and you have things like MySpace. I mean, do you think it would have been easier for James to have break now, or do you think... I mean, do you think the changes in the music industry are positive?
I think it's easier for any band to break now, given access to broadcast... You know, the idea of broadcasting, casting your music to a broad audience was impossible way back in the 80s, unless you got signed to a record label and got your music out there. Whereas now, you just, you know, 10 minutes, you can put up a MySpace page and you can have your music on there and a picture and, you know, send an email to everybody in the world and you might get, you know, a few hits. It's, I think it's very positive for music. very, very positive for people who are interested in listening to it and finding out about it, to the people who play it and want to, you know, carry on playing it, who want to make a career out of it, or just do it for the love of it. It's a fantastic medium. It was almost like it seems it was made for pornography and music. You know, I think both of those industries have really, really benefited from the internet.
But I suppose the thing about music is, there's the legal downloading, so people taking albums and downloading for free hasn't sort of benefited the record companies and probably hasn't benefited the artists as much, and they're not getting as much money as they would have done from record sales way back.
It depends on how one measures benefit to the artist. Definitely doesn't benefit the record company. I think they've made quite a few mistakes in the way that they've handled the MP3 situation. Rather than fighting it, they should have seen the commercial possibilities in it first, rather than treating it as an enemy. They should have treated it as a new process that they should understand and bring under the umbrella of what it is that they do. They're doing that now, 10 years later. In the meantime, what they've done is alienate themselves from the audience, and they've created a subculture of young people who don't expect to pay for music. That was a bad marketing move. It was. They should have, you know, they should have seen the possibilities of it in those early days and just started to make the files readily available for a small fee, which is the situation that we've ended up in now. But no, they just try to protect their profits, and as such, they've messed up. Where the bands are concerned, one of the prime reasons for being a musician is you want your music to be heard. And so file sharing, downloading, obviously benefits that. The fact that the artist won't get paid if there's no money generated, but the income streams come from different places. You know, if a song takes off on the internet or an artist takes off on the internet, you know, whether it be Lillian, Kate Nash, you know, the help that they've got, they now probably have sponsorship deals. They probably have funds coming in from all over the place. Not necessarily. I mean, Lillian, I think she's even done her own clothing range for one of the stores. So it's obviously benefited her. She's getting money from different places. The record company are just sat there, you know, moaning, but artists are benefiting, I think, greatly.
So if people download James's album, Hey Ma, illegally and for free, you don't mind then?
Obviously, I would rather they pay for it, because if it is good to have a relationship with a record company. The relationship between record company and artists is getting more involved nowadays. Like with Madonna, you know, she's working with her promoter. She's not got a record company. Her promoter is going to fund her, because it's a question of live stuff. It's a question of pay-per-view. It's a question of whether they do streaming video on the internet that you pay for or subscribe to, etc., etc. There's, you know, there's money to be had there, and inventive artists and record companies and promoters and managements and things are taking a more holistic view. So I would rather that they paid for it, but I also like that idea of somebody who's a James fan, they put a playlist together for somebody who bought an iPod, you know, in their office or something like that. I heard this one story. Somebody bought an iPod in the office and they didn't know how to, you know, get the music on there. So there was this chap in the office who was good with iPods, and he put loads of James on there, you know, put his playlists on. And a week later he said it made him so... he got a real kick out of hearing this guy walking around with his headphones on, you know, singing one of our songs on his way to the copier or something like that. And that's what music's becoming. It's becoming viral. It's, you know, and James is one of those things, I think one of those hidden gems that people are discovering.
So last question, because I know you've got to go and sound check, but what's the future for James? What are your plans? More albums, more writing, or is this it? Is this the last album, do you think?
No, I don't think that. Plans, I think we've got more hopes than plans. Our plans end at the end of the December tour. That's as far as we've planned so far. But We've already started to write new material. There is material that didn't end up on Hey Ma that we hope to work on and capture for another album. So not at the back of our minds, you know, but secondary at the moment is the next album and how we're going to broach that. We've been recording all these shows live, so we're thinking of a DVD, a live DVD.
Well, all the shows, every gig you've done?
Every gig we've done so far, yeah. We've recorded onto multi-track, you know, because computers make everything dead easy nowadays. So it'll probably be a CD, it won't be a DVD, it won't be visual. So we're just generating music, really, in various ways, and then we'll continue to promote it. It's good fun doing the festivals during the summer, both here and in Europe. Plans to go to America later in the year, before the December tour. And it just depends. I mean, I think this is the first record since Laid, or maybe Whiplash, that's been released in America. Right. And so James has been... America has been starved of James since then. Who knows what will happen? There's no way of telling how many... We didn't know how many fans we had here until those 40,000 tickets sold like that. So there's no telling what might happen in America. So our plans will change. So if we've got any plans, then those plans will change, but there is no end in sight. We haven't set a time limit on this. It's not like 12 months, 18 months, one album, you know. So we'll see.
Larry got there. I hope you enjoyed that. It was well worth it, I think.
Really, really. I mean, there was, when I was trying to edit it for the highlights of the radio, I was struggling to take bits out.
Absolutely.
And very, very insightful, some of the stuff. Really good.
So that's it for this week's Sunday Showcase podcast. We'll be back again next week. The Sunday Showcase is on air between 5 and 9 every Sunday on Original 106, 106.3 FM, 106.8 FM in the Northeast, and online at
www.originalfm.com.
Thank you very much for listening, and keep downloading us.
Goodbye.